to the June 9th edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy, on a beautiful summer morning. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Roger. Good morning, everyone.
We're going to start our morning with author Todd Purdom. He's the author of Desi Arnaz, The Man Who Invented Television. Then we'll hear from Audrey Lind, Allison Russell, and Lindsay Levitt Brown. They're the founders of Folkway Bookshop in Midway. Finally, we'll speak with Dylan Pink from the UPS store and find out what was behind their recent move. All this and more on Mountain Money. On June 19th, 1953, some 44 million Americans tuned in to watch the Lucy Goes to the Hospital episode of I Love Lucy. That's an estimated 71.1% of American households. The Apollo 11 moon landing captured only a slightly higher percentage. I Love Lucy certainly changed television and American culture forever. And while Lucille Ball may have been the face of the program, many of the critical innovations associated with the program were clearly the creation of Desi Arnaz. The story of the Ball-Arnaz relationship and the creation and impact of I Love Lucy, they're documented in a new book, Desi Arnaz, The Man Who Invented Television. We're lucky to be joined by author Todd Purdom this morning, who'll explain a little bit about the book. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Thanks so much for having me. Glad to be here.
So what motivated you to write this book, and how long did it take to do the research?
Well, from the time I started trying to do it, it was about 5 years ago right now. When I really got rolling, it was a little more than 3 years ago. It took a while to get things lined up, to get the cooperation I needed from Lucy Arnaz, Lucy and Desi's daughter, who at the time I was first interested was tangled up in making being the Ricardos, the Aaron Sorkin movie for Amazon. So anyway, I spent about 3+ years on the research and writing, and really enjoyed the process.
And let's talk a little. Let's set the stage a little bit for our audience who may not be familiar with who Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz were. Can you share a little bit about their career arcs prior to I Love Lucy?
Yes, Lucille Ball had grown up in Jamestown, New York, a small town about 90 miles south of Buffalo. And Desi had been born in Cuba, in Santiago, the second largest city on the island, where his father was the mayor and his family, extremely wealthy, aristocratic family. But they lost everything in the Cuban Revolution of 1933 and had to flee to Miami with nothing in their pockets. Lucy, meantime, had done a lot of things. She'd worked as a model. She'd tried to be an actress on Broadway. And she wound up in Hollywood in the early 1930s. And by the time she and Desi met in 1940, she'd already made 60 movies. So then they got married in 1940, and in the 10 years of the first 10 years of their marriage, Lucy kept pursuing her movie career, but never quite became a front rank star. And Desi had a very successful Latin band that toured the country, but they were separated most of the time, and they hardly ever got to see each other. So they came up with the idea of doing I Love Lucy as a way of working together, and frankly, a way of trying to save their marriage.
And you talk about how, you know, the sort of evolution of this concept of I Love Lucy. I guess it starts with this radio program, My Favorite Husband. Can you just set the stage a little bit about the nature of that program and how it sort of led to I Love Lucy?
Yes. In the late 1940s, as her movie career was kind of struggling, Lucille Ball got hired to do a radio sitcom in the last great days of network radio. It was called My Favorite Husband, about a wacky wife and her husband, who was the fifth vice president of a bank. And she was always having these crazy adventures. And in some ways, it foreshadowed the dynamic of I Love Lucy. CBS, she was doing the show for CBS Radio, and they decided they wanted to transfer it to television, which was really growing quickly in popularity. But Lucy only wanted to do a television show if Desi could be her co-star. And Desi himself knew that he could not play the fifth vice president of a bank. He had a thick accent. He didn't seem like an American banker. So he came up with the idea that they should go on a vaudeville tour of movie theaters around the country. He'd take his band, and Lucy could do comedy, and they'd sing and act and dance together to prove to CBS that the audiences around the country would accept them. And that's what happened. And ultimately, CBS took a chance on the pair, and lo and behold, within a few months, I Love Lucy became the number one show on television, a status it kept for most of the 1950s. And it was if, you know, Friends, The Big Bang Theory, an HBO comedy special, and, you know, five or six other popular programs had all been rolled into one. And every week it got about, you know, more than 30 million viewers when the country was about 160 million people. And today, a top-rated show like 60 Minutes or NCIS or, you know, is lucky to get 10 million viewers. So it's that gives you a sense of how dominant it was.
So now the innovations with I Love Lucy, just unbelievable, so many of them. Let's start with the notion of filming the program. Why was this so significant?
Because at the time, Kevin, most of television was a completely live medium, and it was mostly centered in New York, which is where the advertisers were, and television was a sponsor-driven medium. So, but there wasn't yet the means to transmit a television signal coast to coast. So since Lucy and Desi wanted to make the show in Hollywood, CBS said the only way that it could be seen in high quality was if it was filmed, and that was going to cost more. And Desi said, okay, we'll be willing to take a pay cut, but then I want to own the film. And that was a crucial decision that even he didn't really fully understand the implications of at the time, but it was the foundation of what became a business empire for their Desilu Productions, and ultimately made them the largest producer of television content in the world by the end of the 1950s.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that you note in the book is that they go through all these machinations, and we're going to talk a little bit about what it took to actually film a television program, which hadn't been done before. But then as soon as right as they're about to do it, apparently there was a cable laid that would have allowed them to sort of broadcast the television from New York anyway?
Yes, the paradox is just before the show went on the air, the transcontinental coaxial cable and microwave relays did make it possible to have a live signal from coast to coast, but they'd already made the decision to film it, and that's why we still can see the show in reruns today. And in fact, I Love Lucy essentially, with Desi's leadership, invented the television rerun, making it possible for shows to be seen again and again and sold again and again.
So let's talk about, we say it's going to be filmed. That's just the beginning of a very complicated technical set of innovations. Can you explain to the audience a little bit more about what it took to film a television show at the time?
Yes, one of the things they realized, two things. CBS had always felt that Lucy worked best in front of a live audience, as she'd done on a radio show. So that meant they would have to film it in a way that an audience could see it. And they looked at theaters, they looked at nightclubs. Nothing seemed right, and finally they went to the most logical place to film, which was a movie soundstage. The problem is a soundstage is a working factory floor with electrical cables and enormous fire hazards, and there'd never been an audience on a soundstage. It's a working factory. So they came up with this method of having wooden metal bleachers that allowed about 300 people to file into the studio. They had to create a special fire exit to the street. And then, so that they could capture the comedy in real time, they came up with the idea of using three cameras in synchronization at once. And that was also innovative. Ralph Edwards, with his game show, Truth or Consequences, had been experimenting with that, but that's obviously not the same as a sitcom. And then they had to figure out, and they hired an Academy Award-winning cinematographer named Carl Freund to figure out a way to light the set so that you could have long shot, close-up, and medium shot all at the same time with effective lighting. So there was just a whole raft of technical innovations that they relied on to do this.
And I guess many of those technical innovations still sort of drive the way sitcoms look today.
Absolutely. It's how Friends was made. It's how The Big Bang Theory was made. It's how All in the Family and Mary Tyler Moore were made. And, it's really a tremendous legacy of 75 years. It's still basically the same way it's done.
And let's touch a little bit on some of the other major players. Jess Amenheimer, Bob Carroll, Madeline Pugh, excuse me. How important were they to this project?
Hugely important. Jess Oppenheimer had been, and Madeline Pugh and Bob Carroll Jr. had been the writers of My Favorite Husband. Jess Oppenheimer is the man who, with the Writers Guild, filed the little memo that created the character of Lucy Ricardo and the show. And he was the head writer and producer and was absolutely crucial with Desi in getting the show off the ground. Ultimately, a few seasons in, he left, deciding he'd accomplished about all he could. And he and Desi actually had a little bit of tension between them because Desi wanted to step into formal role as an executive producer of the show. That led to some tensions. But the show really wouldn't exist without Jess Oppenheimer. Bob Carroll and Madeline Pugh had been a writing team together. They ultimately worked on all of Lucille Ball's successor shows. And then in the 1970s, they wound up being the showrunners for Alice with the late Linda Lavin. So they had a remarkable and long career in television.
in another one of those moments that probably is much more significant than it seemed at the time. Oppenheimer, as I read in the book, actually owned a 5% share of the show.
He wound up actually owning a 15% share of the show. And when Lucy and Desi sold their interest back to CBS, which is what they used as the seed money, basically, to buy RKO Studios and make themselves into a giant producer of television, Oppenheimer kept his share, and his children still own it today, and they have an ownership stake in I Love Lucy, which runs right today on Paramount Plus.
It's probably running 24 hours a day somewhere.
Someplace in the world.
Okay, so I Love Lucy is a big hit. We get near the end of the run, but Desilu becomes this giant in Hollywood. Talk a little bit more about what was being shot at Desilu and how big a production studio it became.
Yeah, well, it became the largest motion picture plant in L.A., bigger than MGM or Warner Brothers or 20th Century Fox. And between producing its own shows, which by the end of the 1950s included The Untouchables, the crime drama with Robert Stack, they were the landlord for shows like The Danny Thomas Show, Dick Van Dyke, Andy Griffith, and they were really the place to be for television at the end of the 1950s.
So we get to the end of the show. What happens to sort of Desi Arnaz's career post I Love Lucy?
Well, he and Lucy get divorced in 1960 because he just couldn't be faithful to her. He was probably what we would now call a sex addict, and his particular thing was patronizing prostitutes. He also had developed alcoholism. The more successful he got, the more stress he was under, the more he seemed to relieve his tensions by turning to the bottle. So they got divorced in 1960. They stayed in the company together. And then in 1962, Lucy bought him out. And really, the last 25 years of his life were kind of a sad unspooling into depression and addiction. He finally got sober in the last year of his life, but then he died of lung cancer at 69. So it's not really a happy ending. He kind of outlived his glory days.
Did he do any additional performance work after I Love Lucy?
He had one successful series on the air called The Mothers-in-Law in the late 1960s, mm-hmm. with Eve Arden and Kay Ballard. And then he performed in a few television programs. And the last performance he did was in a movie directed by Caleb Deschanel called The Escape Artist, Griffin O'Neill, Ryan O'Neill's son, Tatum's brother. And it was a drama in which he played a corrupt mayor and the father of the Puerto Rican actor Raul Julia. And it was a powerful performance, but by that point his health had really suffered. He was quite diminished. He wrote his memoirs in 1976 and appeared on the first season of NBC's Saturday Night Live, playing the conga drum and doing a bunch of sketches. So he never quite gave up. He didn't have good luck in the last part of his life.
I now have to look up the Saturday Night Live.
Oh, it's worth watching. It's worth watching because the episode ends with a conga line. And Al Franken told me that the show was running a little short that night, so the dance had to go on longer than expected, and they were afraid that Desi was pounding the drum so vigorously that he might have a heart attack.
Okay, so let's talk about Lucy's career post I Love Lucy.
She went on to have two different series, one called The Lucy Show, which was kind of like I Love Lucy, but only she and Vivian Vance, who'd played Ethel, were two single women, a widow and a divorcee, who were living in Connecticut with their children, and they had all kinds of crazy misadventures, pretty much like the I Love Lucy ones. And then in the late 60s, she started a series called Here's Lucy, which for quite a while had both her own children, real-life children, Desi Arnaz Jr. and Lucy Arnaz. And that ended in 1974. And Lucy didn't die till 1989, and the last 15 years of her life were kind of a frustrating imprisonment of collecting life achievement awards and being honored in a million ways, but not really having a lot of work that was satisfying to her.
I want to go back. We've talked about sort of what I would label as technical innovations. There's some pretty substantial cultural innovations associated with I Love Lucy, starting with the fact that we have Lucy, this very white-bred, traditional American person, married to this Cuban. How big a deal was that?
It was a very big deal at the time, and one of the reasons that CBS and any prospective sponsors were reluctant to have Desi on the show is they didn't think the American public would accept this inter-ethnic marriage. And in fact, the public proved itself to be far ahead of the suits and the business people, and they embraced Ricky Ricardo and Desi Arnaz as an all-American dad and husband who, you know, really was a pathbreaker at a time when television was almost exclusively white and WASPy and, you know, not very diverse at all.
And the other cultural innovation that I think was significant was pregnancy. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, they did sleep in twin beds, but she nonetheless was pregnant and had a baby. That was unusual at the time, wasn't it?
Yes, it was very unusual for the time. CBS said, and Philip Morris, the cigarette company that was the sponsor, said there's no way you can do this. And the alternative would have been to stop the show because Lucille Ball was pregnant in real life and the pregnancy would show. There was no way to hide it. So ultimately they persuaded the company to allow these series of episodes leading up to the birth and ultimately the birth of the baby. And as you said at the beginning, on January 19th, 1953, the real-life Desi Arnaz Jr. was born that morning at Cedars of Lebanon in Los Angeles. And that night on television, little Ricky Ricardo was born, and more people watched that show that night than watched the inauguration of President Eisenhower the next morning.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Now, this sounds like a fun fun book to have done the research. Did you enjoy it?
I enjoyed it very much, and I have to say that I'm incredibly in debt to Lucy Arnaz, who gave me open access to her family archive, giving me papers and documents, letters, medical reports that she'd never shared with other people before. And it allowed me to paint, I think, a very full and nuanced picture of Desi's talents and also the demons that, you know, undermined his success. And it was really a joyous exercise to try to put myself back in that world, not only about Desi's life, but as you've noted in your really thoughtful questions, the beginning of television and the early days of this medium that has come to be so important in our daily lives. Lucy and Desi were really present at the creation of that. And that's been fun to sort of put myself back in that world.
You referenced the Aaron Sorkin film. Let's talk a little bit about the Red incident, because this was extraordinary in the sense that anybody who was even remotely linked to communism during that time was basically run out of town. Can you explain what happened and how she pulled this off?
Yes, what happened was in the early 1930s, Lucy's father had died before she was 3 years old, and she was effectively raised in large part by her grandparents, and her grandfather, Fred Hunt, particularly was her father figure. He was an old line socialist who in 1933 urged his whole family, and by then Lucy had brought them to live with her in Hollywood, to register on the Communist Party line. And we have to remember that in the early 1930s, in the depth of the Depression, many Americans were flirting with socialism, communism, experimenting with how they could get out of this terrible economic crisis. So years later, after World War II, any association with communism came to be seen as a terrible thing as the Cold War was heating up. And somebody had leaked the fact that this registration card had Lucille's name on it. And she'd been quietly questioned by the House Un-American Activities Committee, and she thought she'd resolved it. But then Walter Winchell had a blind item on his radio show, and this exploded into public in 1 week in the fall of 1953. And it seemed like it could completely derail Lucy's career. Remember, she was the number one show on the air. She was extremely popular. She and Desi were beloved figures. And Desi really is the one who handled the situation. He got their friend J. Edgar Hoover to say that Lucy was completely clear of any guilt. He got the congressman who was on the committee to hold a press conference in downtown Los Angeles saying that, you know, this was all understood and explained. And that was the night that they were filming the season debut of the third season of I Love Lucy, and they weren't sure how the audience would react. Mm-hmm. And Desi did the warm up of the audience and said, "Here's my wife, my favorite. The only thing that's red about her is her hair, and even that isn't legitimate." And the audience gave her a standing ovation, and she diffused the whole crisis. But for the space of a few days, it looked like her career might be over.
Before we go, I wonder if you could share with the audience a bit about the mechanics of doing that show. How would a typical week work?
That's a good question. They'd start out on Monday morning with the conferences about the script and working through it, and they would go over. They'd sit around a table and read the script, and apparently Desi was very, very good at the first reading. He never got worse. He never got better, whereas Lucy was slow. She would noodle around about the props, what to do. There's a very good scene in Being the Ricardos where Nicole Kidman playing Lucy fusses around with a bouquet of flowers, figuring out how to make the funniest use of them. And then in the beginning, they would film on Friday nights. Later, they moved it up to Thursday nights. But they basically go through the week having a series of very disciplined readings of the script, then some blocking, then some dress rehearsals, and then they'd film the show in front of the live audience in continuity, just like a play. They would do retakes afterwards if absolutely necessary, but they would try to go straight through it without any you know, stopping. And then in the middle of all that, they'd have to start thinking ahead to the next week's episode. So it was a pretty intense work schedule.
Now, I've done a few sitcoms, and that's still how they, well, back in the 90s.
Yeah, I mean, before the stream, it's still pretty much how a writer's room works, you know?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
The book's title credits aren't as with the invention of television. Do you think is that really a fair sort of summary of his career?
Well, it's a kind of, you know, I stole that from NPR's Planet Money, which had an episode a few years ago called Desi, hat tip to NPR. But it's a slight hyperbole, but what it's meant to convey is that he was part of a team of people there in the founding years of television who really came up with the methods and the systems and the technology that are still used today. And I think one of my goals in writing the book was to explain to readers today who may not know who Desi was at all and certainly may not understand the role he played in the early days of television, to get a sense of just how important his contributions were. And they went way beyond playing straight man to Lucy. It was really a remarkable business story as well.
It must have been very stressful because he was running Desi Lu, he was running the show, and he was acting in the show.
Yes, and he said after a while he could have, you know, like the act playing Ricky was like rolling off a log. But somebody said, his secretary recalled how somebody called and trying to reach Desi one day and said, I can reach the President of the United States easier than I can reach Desi. And the secretary said, but he doesn't have to do a show every week, too. So it was a lot of stress.
He built an amazing empire. He leaves an amazing legacy. The book is Desi Arnaz, The Man Who Invented Television. We've been speaking with author Todd Purdom. It's a great read. Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thanks so much for having me, you guys. I'm very grateful.
A good bookshop is a special place. You can easily pick up the next book that you want to read or get information to help you find a new book to read. You may also find different events at the bookshop that you may want to join in on. We have that bookshop here in Midway, Folklore Bookshop, and we're joined by co-owners Allison Russell and Lindsay Levitt Brown. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning. Good
morning.
Okay, so you have three owners.
Yes.
And you're all Midway locals.
Correct.
Yes.
Well, gotta love that.
Yeah.
Now, hopefully this is okay. Were you friends before you started the business? Did you know one another?
So Lindsay and I did. We
yes.
are actually neighbors.
And more important, we're still friends.
Yeah. Yeah.
After starting the business.
So we actually our daughters participated in a volunteer program several years ago. As we were volunteering together as parents, we had lots of conversations about how we wanted to make our community better and what we could bring to it. And Lindsay is actually a children's author. And I have a great love of reading. I grew up going to my local bookstore, the King's English in Salt Lake City, and always loved that part of it. And so we talked about different businesses we'd like to do, and kind of we arrived on our community really needs a bookstore. And then from there, Lindsay and Audrey knew each other. I didn't really know Audrey, but she kind of brought us all together. And
yeah, our first business meeting was the first time that Allison and Audrey met each other.
And we are still friends, too. Yes. And we have become fast friends.
So. Audrey has a background. She's a librarian. So I saw her at one of our kids' sporting games, and she was reading a book. And I thought, that's our person right there. And Audrey also is a resident of Park City. Yeah. And Allison has roots in Park City as well.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Very,
so
very local.
So Wasatch back.
Wasatch back.
So you guys decide you want to do a business. You take a deep breath. Talk a little about the vision of the business model. What is it that made you guys think that this could work, and what is it that you wanted to do?
That's fun that you think we've taken a deep breath in the last year. our goal has always been to create a literary third space or place in the Wasatch Back. And so everything comes back to that. We're there to have retail, we're there to sell books, but we're also really there to create an experience. And we want to meet the needs of our community locally, but we're also meeting the needs of Utah at large. Like Park City, we're very much a tourist town and continue to become one. So we want, from that moment you walk in the door, to feel like you're a part of Folklore Bookshop, to feel like you're a part of that community. We have people who come to our book clubs who drive sometimes 2 hours away just to be a part of that experience that we've created. And that's something that, in when we're curating our collection, we want to make sure that that continues to be an experience.
Yeah, so book club is one of your events that you hold.
Mm-hmm.
And what nights are that?
We have 5 different book clubs now. The Midway Murder Club is tonight at 7 p.m. I am making tea sandwiches for that. We also have a Buzzy Books Club that is new releases. We have a Macabre Monday. That's the first Monday of the month, and that's dark fiction. We are starting a Parent Kid Book Club, Folklore Friends, and that is the third Monday. And then we also have
a fantasy book club
that is
the last Thursday of the month. So lots of fun things.
Yeah. You're busy.
Yes, we are. Last week alone, well, we had 2 events. We had, and this wasn't a book club, but a fun one. It was a book bedazzling event. We had that last Thursday night, and really fun, great turnout. People came from all over. And then the next day, we kicked off our summer reading challenge for children in our community to, and we collaborated with that one with the Pizza Yard in Midway. So they have a summer reading challenge, and if they meet that challenge, then they get a coupon from us. Yep, they get a
pizza.
Free personal sized pizza from the Pizza Yard, kind of a kickback to the Pizza Hut, you know, reading incentive program that like we grew up with.
So walk us through the shop real quick. About how many square feet?
We're 2,200, so a good size. I mean, one comment that has been, I think, a lot, again, kind of going back to the question of, like, why we felt this was a need in our community. People walked in immediately. I think they thought it was going to kind of be almost a pop-up, retail experience, but they walk in and they immediately see the extensive curation of books and merchandise that we've created and brought in, and they're just the space itself, I think, has been a real surprise and delight to people, which in turn is great for us. We love it.
And I assume in that 2,200 square feet, we've got books, we have some merchandise, we have places to sit and look at books.
Yeah, for sure. That's one of the things we felt was really strongly about was when Lindsay was talking about providing a third space for our community, was having a space for people to come and sit and not feel like rushed out, like come buy something and then leave. We really wanted, so we did give up some retail square footage. We could have brought in more books, but we really wanted to have, we have a sitting area with couches and chairs, and we also have a countertop area for people to come and do work or just sit, because that's another need that we found in Heber Valley, especially, is there's kind of a lack of coffee shops in place for people who work remotely or, you know, whatever to have.
Do you have coffee?
We are working on it.
We have hot chocolate from the Food Nanny, and we have tea presently, and we have plenty of Diet Coke for us to share with all. But we do hope that it's a space. I've actually counted it, and there's about 6 people that I've counted have fallen asleep on the couch. And to me, that's an experience right there.
Now, late last summer, Roger and I interviewed an author of a bookshop book.
Mm-hmm.
And just from reading that book, your bookshop, everything I read online and a couple of chats, you seem to fit right into that old world, you know, feel good as soon as you walk through the door kind of bookshop. So what makes your bookshop different?
Well, one question, you said old world, is we really did want to conjure some history and weight into the space. So physically and design, aesthetically, it feels old, and people ask all the time, how long has this building been here? And it's a brand new building. So, but that's something like I really cherish in bookshops is, you know, a lot of times they have kind of a cobbled together look, but a sense of history. And so we really wanted to do that, you know, so aesthetically we chose colors and finishes that made it feel like that. But also in the curation, we try to select not only books, but retail items that are classic and long-term. And, you know, referring to our name, also folklore, we want to cherish, you know, traditional forms of literature, but then we also really want to lean into new authors, new genres, new stories.
Let's talk about curation. How many titles do you typically carry about?
We checked this the other day. Right now we have about 10,000 ISBNs and about 15,000 copies in our 2013.
So somebody has to get up on Monday morning and think about, what are we going to order next? How do you go about that process? And, you know, how does that from a business sense, how does that work?
So Audrey and I are co-book buyers together, and Allison focuses on sideline and merchandising mm-hmm. for the store. And so we started working on that a Monday morning, months and months before we opened. We basically kind of created a pie chart and said, this is how much retail space we have for each genre. So here's how many books we need to select for that genre. And we wanted to have it be a mix of favorites and classics as well as new releases. And I still don't know how it works. We're still making a lot of mistakes, but really we're all readers, and it has changed as we've talked to our customers, and we want to make sure that we're meeting the needs of what our customers want, but at the same time, we're trying to teach them what they don't know yet that they want as well.
Do publishers share new releases with you to try to, is that how you figure it out? I'm really
yes.
curious, as to how do you do this, right?
So we meet with our publisher reps. We have at least 5 different accounts, and then we also work with some larger distributors for some of the smaller publishers. They pitch to us the larger books. Right. We also get a real great perk of working in a bookstore is ARCs or ARCs, which is advanced reader copies. So most, like the book I'm reading right now comes out next January. So we're anticipating what's going to be the trends. Also the publishers, they give us a lot of free stuff, which is really fun. And that
they
helps
give us some free stuff
yes,
too.
And it
so
helps
we
us. Yeah. Yeah. We should share some of our free stuff. But that helps us anticipate. But it's happened that sometimes we have no idea what's going to be the next big hit.
Yeah.
And we quickly order the book. But our guesstimates, our very educated guests, have done really well so far. And that's been a compliment that we've gotten. Sometimes I have someone who comes in and they'll have a, especially in the nonfiction section, how did you know about this book? Who bought this book? And I'll say, I did. It was me. And I think they're kind of floored that sometimes when we're in the Wasatch Back, people think that we're this small town that maybe we have small town thoughts or something, that we are... This is all the field of study that we're in. We often make the joke that a retailer, a children's author, and a librarian walked into a bar and it turned into a bookstore. So we all have our background together. Has been a really lovely combination that we have all of our strengths together work really well. And that goes in curation, that goes in experience, and that goes in the overall experience too.
Yeah, so you are an author. Do you find time to write?
I remember writing. That was fun. I had a book come out. It's called The Garden Just Beyond. That came out May 20th. And that's a middle grade book. It's a magical, fantastical adventure for middle school and younger elementary kids. No, I have not found time since we've opened, but I have plans to switch over into adult, and I have a murder mystery that is set here that I've been hoping to work on for some time.
A murder mystery. Is it fiction, nonfiction?
It's fiction. Yeah. So far.
Hasn't happened yet.
Yeah.
And she's been talking about it since we
I got the
since
idea
we started
when we
talking
worked together.
About this.
Our kids were Swiss Miss together, and that's when I got the idea.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Kevin made reference to an interview we did last year about bookstores. And that book talked about the challenge that independent bookstores face in a world of Barnes & Noble and Amazon. Talk to us a little bit about how you price, and then how do you sort of explain to your customers the value proposition of patronizing a store like yours?
Well, books are fixed costs, and they're one of the only retail items that has a price listed on it. And so some of the things we have to do is we have to be creative. We sell bargain books, so we have some better profit margins on those. We don't offer used books, but that's a way to meet at a different price point. We also have our merchandise that Allison has beautifully curated that, you know, that might have a different cost. But really, we don't have as much of a luxury as some of those big box retailers. They have different margins. So the pricing being set, how do we find a margin that we can actually have profitability?
And talk about, we've sort of made glancing reference to some of the other merchandise. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit more so our listeners can get a sense of what they would get to see when they came into the store, other than books.
Yeah, so, you know, we're located in Midway. Midway's a fairly growing community, especially in the kind of commercial retail. Like, there's a lot of exciting things happen. We are lucky because we are a bookshop, and we've really, in terms of like retail merchandise or non-book merchandise, we've really leaned into kind of the bookish lifestyle. So when I'm selecting things, I really look, is this something a reader would appreciate? You know, a blanket or a mug for their coffee or tea. You know, like, we really kind of lean into that, and it makes it our decisions easy. And our reps also, our retail reps, have been really helpful in steering us away from those products that maybe another store would select. And so I think people really appreciate that. And it's also, again, given kind of a timeless classic feel to our store, where there's always something for everyone and something unique. So that's what we've really worked hard on.
And I think, Allison, you've introduced a lot of whimsy, too. A lot of people laugh, like, whether it's just an item or a sticker. We have a very large pigeon that could be used as a murder weapon that is also
it's
used
a bookend.
Is it going to be in the
it's
book?
It's a bookend,
yeah.
too.
Oh, yeah.
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 No, I can't do that.
No, now
no one
we can't
used
do
that.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But even a sticker, it's fun that as they're kind of on that merchandising journey through the store, you see them laugh at something, you see them notice something. And so all the merchandising is really connected to what the books are giving as well. Because we want really someone to buy a book, and then we want someone to buy a sticker and a shirt and a hat and everything else with that.
So people come to you for your expertise. And as we get near the end of this interview, Allison, I'm going to walk into the bookstore. I need a good new fiction book. What are you going to tell me?
Oh, my goodness. Well, there's one that just came out last Tuesday. It's by Taylor Jenkins Reid. It's called Atmosphere. I was lucky enough to get an advanced copy of that, and I read it in February. Taylor Jenkins Reid, she is a... she does a lot of kind of historical fiction, but not in the way you would think about it. She takes kind of historical figures and does kind of a riff or an amalgamation of them. And this one is an amalgamation of Sally Ride and the space program in the 1980s. And it is just a touching, wonderful memoir. I think it's great for everyone. It has wonderful universal messages about love, about life, about courage. And I just love it. And it's a beautiful cover and a beautiful story.
And Lindsay, you can do nonfiction.
I'm looking here at your Desi Arnaz book that you're reading here. And I would tell you that in the fall, there's another book about the love story between Desi and Lucy that's coming out. So usually I would say, tell me the last thing you read and why that interested you. And then we would riff off of that.
Yeah. Now, how about author signing, book signings?
Oh, do we ever?
Oh, yes.
Yes, we do.
Yes.
We have one next Tuesday. We have Fairy Tales and Fantasy. We have three fantasy authors who are coming to speak on a panel together. We also have, in the works, we have a romance cowboy author that is coming in July. And then during Swiss Days, we're going to have a whole lineup of authors alternating on the hour as well.
How many are going to come through?
Probably 8 to 10.
Amazing. Well, we just spent a few minutes with Lindsay and Allison from Folklore Bookshop down in Midway. Thank you very much for joining
Thank
us.
Thank you.
And we'll be back in just one moment.
Hi, this is Tony Tyler with Columbus Pacific Development, a longtime supporter of KPCW. We are proud to announce the opening of the new Pendry Plaza at Canyons Village. With available garage parking, 14 new shops and restaurants, and outdoor games on the grounds, the Pendry Plaza is an inviting new place to explore in Park City.
Congress will soon vote on a proposal to repeal funding they previously approved for public media, an action called rescission. Further, the president's FY26 budget calls for eliminating funding to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This funding is essential to KPCW, providing direct support through federal grants and indirect support through services and infrastructure supported by CPB. The time to save public media funding is now. Your calls to Congress matter. Please go to kpcw.org and click the public media funding button to learn how you can reach your congressional representatives. Tell them what KPCW means to you and your community.
Thank you for taking action.
This is Sean with the bike rental shop at Jan's, a longtime supporter of KPCW. We rent mountain bikes, gravel bikes, e-bikes, and kids' bikes. Located on the corner of Park Avenue and Deer Valley Drive, 435-649-4949 or jans.com.
Well, we all know the UPS store over by the closed movie theater off Kearns, but now it's no longer there. It has moved about 300 yards south to their new location on Iron Horse. That's 875 Iron Horse, to be exact. Same great staff and owners, so I was curious as to the reason behind the move. Joining us in studio is Dylan Pink from the UPS store. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Right on. So how long were you guys at the previous location?
Oh, gosh. So we have been there since time immemorial, as far as I'm concerned. That location predates the current owners. I think they opened it at first in the late 90s, and the current owners bought it in, I think, 04. So it's been there a long time.
That's a long time for one location. And so you have the new location.
Mm-hmm.
Why the move?
Yeah. Why the move? That's the big question.
Yeah.
Go straight to it. It's nothing super exciting. It was, so we are a franchise, right? Local owners, but we're still beholden to the orders from on high with our corporate office. And so for the past 5 years or so, they've been rolling out across the nation remodels of all the UPS stores. And it came time for us to do our remodels up here at both the now Iron Horse / Park Ave location and our one out in Kimball Junction. And the other big stipulation that we have from our corporate office that led to this change is wherever we're leasing our storefront, we have to have a 10-year lease. Hmm. And so our landlords at the old location were unable to offer us that. But luckily, same owners of this different building, they had that space open up over on Iron Horse, so we were just able to make the transition real smooth. Rather than remodeling the old location, we just built from the ground up the same interior that we would have had there.
Same owners, that's easy.
Same owner, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Fantastic.
Easy transition.
Is it bigger or smaller than the old one?
It is a little bit bigger, but roughly the same shape, which I thought was interesting. You know, the old store was very, you could see clear from the front straight to the back, and it's the same kind of setup at the new one. So it feels not too different.
Pretty were you able to add more mailboxes, the new one?
So one of the big changes that we've made with this remodel, and this is at all UPS stores, is rather than having exclusively physical mailboxes, which is what we had before, we now have what they're calling virtual mailboxes. Rather than receiving your mail in, you know, the physical box, we just have a big bank of filing cabinets where we keep a bunch of people's mail. And that increased our capacity quite substantially. We were able to, you know, keep everyone from the old location and have a little bit more for newcomers, which is a constant demand with our stores.
So that's great for people who are only here for a few months out of the year. They can still mm-hmm. get their mail, and when they come back after months, because I know if you have a mailbox at your house, if you don't pick it up in yep. 2 weeks,
so how does that work, and why is that secure? It's in a file cabinet.
They're big. It's not your conventional file cabinets, right there. It's a big horizontal bank, locked file cabinets that we keep secured back there. And so, rather than, you know, letting clients come up and select from the bank of filing cabinets where they grab anyone's mail, we just go back and have a dedicated staff member for retrieving the mail and packages and whatnot for our clients.
So let's go back, zoom out a little bit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you hear the term UPS store. I assume it's where I can send mail or send UPS packages.
Sure.
But give us the scope of the activities that you guys do. What's the vision of the store?
Yeah. So primarily, or most frequently, we are the shipping store, right? People come in to send packages to family members, returns to Amazon and other online retailers. We, of course, have the mailboxes, so that's receiving mail and packages. We kind of try to be a better alternative to P.O. boxes by having more comprehensive service, right? P.O. box, you can only get stuff from the Postal Service in a lot of locations. For us, we like to accept anything. We've had folks, you know, accidentally have their groceries delivered to the UPS store because they forgot to change their address to their home address. And so, you know, anything you need delivered, we'll take it. But beyond that, what people oftentimes don't realize is we are a print shop. We do blueprints, cards, you know, whatever you need printed, most of the time we can do it. We have notary services, fax services. You know, we try to be kind of an office space for people who don't have an office space. You can come in and do all your printing and document needs if you don't have access to a printer at home, if you don't have a shredder. If, you know, we have a lot of folks come in with a backlog of 20 years worth of old documents that they need to dispose of, and they, you know, their dinky little under the desk shredder is not going to cut it, so they come to us. So we try to be a one-stop shop for a lot of those sort of office-ish needs that people might not be equipped for at home.
Yeah. I know I've done large format printing there. Mm-hmm. Mark has done notary service for me. Yep. Quite a few times, which is...
When you say large format printing, how big, you know, can you...
So at the Iron Horse location, we've had to kind of...
diversify.
Delegate our two locations. So right. At the Kimball Junction location, our large format printing looks like anything but paper. We have a big flatbed printer out there that does more decorative stuff. We can print on foam, metal canvas. That's where people come if they need like their photos printed and they want it to look real nice on some, you know, material besides paper. At the Iron Horse location, that's where we have our big giant roll paper printer. So we do blueprints. That's where we would do banners because that has to come out on a roll. Mm-hmm. And so depending on your need, you'll go to a different location, but we try to cover as much as possible between the two.
What about printing on magnets?
On a magnet, that would be a Kimball Junction one. That big printer that we have out there will print on, as far as I know, pretty much anything that can lay flat. I have a customer who I've been working with on getting some mugs printed in there.
Wow.
Still experimenting with that, so this is a disclaimer. I don't know if I can do mugs, but we're working on being able to do mugs. We've done golf balls on that.
T-shirts.
The owner, T-shirts. Now, I know for sure it'll print on a T-shirt. Mm-hmm. I have no idea how well it'll hold up in the wash.
Yeah.
With the ink that we use. So, another disclaimer.
Yeah.
We'll do it. We'll print on it. Can't guarantee that it'll hold up.
How big a volume results from people returning things to online retailers like the Amazons of the world?
That is the most common reason that folks come into the UPS store these days. You know, probably 8 or 9 times out of 10, someone walks in the door, they've got an Amazon return. And for us, we view that as an opportunity to just get people in the door, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone, pretty much these days, has Amazon purchases or other online retailers that they're returning stuff to, and that draws them into us. And so we use that as an opportunity to give them as much information as possible while they're in the store about what else they can do there, right? The big giant printer is a good, it advertises itself because they walk in and they say, what the heck is that thing behind you? And we get the opportunity to say, well, we can print on anything, come back. So it
do you get
works
some
out.
Small payment from that, or is it almost?
We do. Amazon
good.
Does, yeah, compensate us and the other online retailers. And you know, it could always be more, but we're certainly, yeah, we're not going hungry with that stuff.
So you see a lot of Amazon. Do you? What other large what other retailers do you see with a lot of volume?
Our other biggest returns client is a service called Happy Returns, and they cover a lot of different online retailers. And so it's the same system as Amazon. If y'all have ever done an Amazon return, they give you a little QR code. You bring it in, we scan it. Happy Returns works the same way. You just bring your items in and we scan the little QR code. So it's very convenient for those returns for the consumer, right? You just get the little digital thing and we scan it. And so Happy Returns, I couldn't tell you a comprehensive list of all the different brands and online shops that they cover, but it is a lot.
Now, do people have to bring the box that it came in so that you put the...
With Happy Returns, never. They actually are very specific. They don't want the shipping packaging with those returns. With Amazon, and this is one of our frequent conversations that we have with customers, is... It depends. There are certain items that they want in a box and certain ones that they don't. And a lot of times it depends on the size. So 16 inches in any dimension is generally the rule of thumb for if it needs to be in a box. If it's over 16 inches, they're going to want it packed up. If it's under, they may not. The way to tell, for those of you at home who are planning on bringing an Amazon return into the UPS store today, is right underneath your QR code. It'll either say no box, no label, or it'll say customer packed. If it says customer packed, it's got to be in a box or bag. Otherwise, we won't be able to take it.
Yeah, but if I bring it in and it has to be customer packed and I didn't do that, you do that as an extra service.
We absolutely have the means to pack it. For, you know, a nominal fee.
Yeah, and that brings up sort of another thing. If I want to send something to my cousin and I don't know how to pack it, I can bring it in and you guys will sell me the package and help me figure out how to do it in a way that it won't break, hopefully.
Yep, absolutely. All of our employees at the UPS store go through training for packing to make sure that anyone that you work with there knows how to keep stuff secure and safe when it's traveling.
Wonderful. The UPS store. So what's the address of the other one?
The Kimball Junction location is at 6300 Sagewood Drive in Kimball Junction, right up the hill from Smith's.
Yeah, right by the Chase Bank.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful. Okay, we've been speaking with Dylan Pink of the UPS store. Thanks for coming in and joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Please subscribe to the Mountain Money podcast to stay on top of all the latest episodes of KPCW's Mountain Money.
If you have any ideas for Mountain Money, please shoot us an email at mountainmoney@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.